Welcome to Let's Talk About Test Baby, a fortnightly podcast where I hide behind software testing sofa before leaping out and shouting boo. Hello listeners and welcome to episode 58, a super special bonus episode, which is going to be the second part of my, the second of my interviews with Lee. We referenced the previous episode quite a lot in it, which is why I didn't want to wait a fortnight. So because this is a bonus episode, I will be back next week with a proper episode, if you will, which won't be an interview episode. It will just be me talking to you. So I'm not going to take too much time. I'm just going to jump straight into the interview and I'll see you on the other side. And once again, I'm with Lee Rathbone. Welcome again. First person to be on the podcast twice.
Wow, that's a real privilege. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for coming back. And so this time we're going to talk about the future of testing.
We are. Quite a deep conversation, I think this one will be.
Yeah.
Because many people have different views of what the future of testing will be. I'd like to start with going back to 2011. There was a testing conference in Manchester called Eurostar. It goes round Europe, and it just happened to be that 2011, it was Manchester's turn to host it. And it was a pivotal point in my career because James Whittaker, who at the time it was from Google, fantastic talker. If anybody hasn't watched James Whittaker present, just go onto YouTube, type in James Whittaker. The one I'd probably recommend, which is the funniest, is his talk about big data, which is really funny. He talks about hot tubs and how hot tubs are the future of testing and technology and the Internet of Things. But he really brings it to life. He's very funny. Great talker. So he comes out 2011 onto the stage of Eurostar. And he looks at 800 testers and he looks all of them in the eye and he goes, "Testing is dead." And honestly, the reaction in the room was, "Oh Christ."
Yeah.
It was like a few nervous laughs. You could see people look at each other and go, "Oh my God, what's he talking about?" But actually, as his talk went on, you could see why he was actually saying the opposite.
Yeah.
He was saying testing is very much alive. So with this talk, I'd like to put my slant on why I think testing is not dead.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a great believer in thinking testing will die if you allow it to. But if you take action now, and if you think about the future of testing, if you see what's on the horizon, testing is actually very alive. It's vibrant. One example, the gatherings.
Yeah.
So last night I was talking to Mark and I said, testing for me feels to be on the wave of creating communities and doing gatherings. There seems to be a real energy in Britain at the moment for, and I'm using Britain because I only know Britain, but I'm sure this is happening around the world, of testers coming together in a community. And I think that is one reason why testing simply won't die, is because testers have a real passion for our trade. And we have a real passion to get out there, do self-development, go to these gatherings, these community events, do flash talks, do podcasts.
Yeah.
And I do sense there's a real energy vibrancy around testing at the moment. And while that exists, I don't think testing will die. I think it's very much alive. But there's loads more reasons why I think testing is very, very much alive. If I could just start with just bringing to life the what I call the Old Testament and the New Testament. See what I did there? Testament. Yeah. Put the word test in there. So the Old Testament to me is where you have a standalone test team that is completely and utterly responsible for all of testing. And when things go wrong,
they
get blamed.
Yep.
That's the Old Testament.
Failure,
So if we stay in that world, testing will die.
Yeah.
However, now I believe that testing, the New Testament is where everybody does a form of testing. Everybody is accountable and responsible for quality. And let's face facts. Users can test better than us for usability.
Yeah.
Developers can test better than us at unit level.
Exactly.
So for me, and this was a real key point from James Whittaker, was testers or test teams, test managers, need to get to the point where to stop testing dying, we need to enable others.
Yeah.
And he brought a great example to life. I've got to give it you. It's absolutely brilliant. It was the Google one-click bug.
Okay.
So Google Maps had X amount of people developing it, working on it. And, of course, how the hell do you test Google Maps?
Yeah.
It's bloody massive. It's the world.
Yeah.
Right, in a map. So he said that, you know, to get the better test coverage, they decided to enable others. So the way they enabled others was to get everybody in Google to test Google Maps.
Yep.
So that became quite difficult, because if you're not a tester and you're told to test, and you're told...
Seems all right at the moment, but I don't
know. So if you're told to test, and when you find an issue, if you're not a tester, and someone says to you, go to this test management tool and raise a defect, what's your first initial reaction going to be if you're not a tester and someone throws up Quality Centre as an example?
It's going to be like, oh.
Yeah, it's going to be, what are all these fields? Yeah, what do I do with this? It's got a title, a summary. Oh my God, it's got a priority. How do I know to fill all this crap out? So guess what? People won't raise defects.
Mm-hmm.
People say, no, I tested that and there was nothing wrong with it. And that's what they found at Google. They found that they weren't getting any defects through, and they knew there was defects in there. So how the hell could they enable users, like the receptionist at Google who was testing, how could they enable a receptionist to add value? So they came up with the idea, the test team came up, or test engineers came up with the idea of, why don't we create a one-click bug?
Yeah.
So it was enabling others. So if you're a receptionist and the email comes in, hey, down everything and start testing Google Maps, all she had to do was press a button. I think it might have been F5, F6 or something. And when she found an issue, all she had to do was press that button, and in the background, everything populated the defect for her.
Yeah.
Telemetry, last 50 keystrokes, a video, a cached video. All the fields got populated and sent off to a triage team.
Yeah.
So she didn't have to worry about all that, and all that came from the test team. And I love the way James Whittaker said, and this is the essence of testing going forward, test teams, enable others to test as well as yourselves.
Yeah.
And we've already spoken about the four quadrants of testing. Well, if you pull up that four quadrants of testing from the internet, if you go into Google and just search agile quadrants of testing, you'll see a diagram. We spoke about it in the last podcast. For me, testers will try and do as much in those quadrants as possible, but actually they need to enable others, like the developers.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where James Whittaker got his message across so well, is actually one way testing won't die is if testers change their mindset.
Yeah.
It's not on all our shoulders anymore. It's about enabling others to test and add value. So I was at Test Bash, God, probably 2 years ago, down in Brighton, and some crazy dude got up and drew a diagram on the overhead projector. And it was just basically showing that a test team can't capture every single defect.
No.
Defects will get through, and it's about the people after us. If we enable the people after us to catch it, like UAT, they'll catch some defects that we simply can't, because A, we probably don't have the equipment, we don't have the mindset of a user, we don't know their business processes to the nth degree.
Yeah.
So of course they're going to find defects. But enable them earlier.
Yeah.
Enable them quicker. Bring them in quicker. And that's why I love Agile, because you're bringing them in much quicker.
Yeah. If you're dropping them a new set of work every 3 weeks, you'll figure out if you've done something wrong a lot sooner, and you can change course and switch that around, which has happened. I've been in quite a few projects, and there's some projects where we've dropped sprint one and they've gone, this content type is not going to work for us at all, we need to fix it. There's been some fields that we've missed something in planning or whatever, and that's been like, fine. Whereas if we'd done that at the end of the project and we'd built a whole site around these content types, that's a whole project needs reworking.
Exactly, yeah.
But I think one of the episodes that I've been trying to write, but I've been having issues getting out as I want it, is enabling clients to test in UAT and teaching them how to test.
Yeah.
Because it's things like, I discovered one of our clients the other day did not know that you could put plus whatever before at gmail.com to get a new email address.
Okay.
He was complaining that because it was testing a registration field that he'd run out of email addresses, like valid ones. I'm like, you just need to put plus whatever after your username before at gmail.com, you will get a new email address. He was like, I never heard that before. And it's that simple stuff that I use every day in my testing.
Yeah.
And it made his life so much easier, because he could, instead of going around asking other people to in his team to put email addresses in, he could control that and do it all himself and check that emails were being sent out properly.
Yeah.
So enabling, for me, the biggest thing at the moment that I'm trying to do is how to enable the client to test stuff.
Yeah, so you're talking client as in, is that someone that is the end user of your software?
It depends. It can be either. We've got clients who are the end user of software if we're doing something for an internal.
Yeah.
Or we have clients where the end user is actually their customers.
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes they'll say, right, I've got some people, some customers, like a focus group to come and test. So we've got to, you know, there's two lots of UAT. There's the UAT of the client and then there's the end user's UAT as well.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different fish to get involved in.
And this is where I think the gaming industry is light years ahead of everybody else. So going back 10 years ago, the industry that drove technology was the adult film industry, porn.
Yeah. And porn has drove all technology.
Yeah, so they were rendering videos and taking payments on mobile phones in 2002, 2003, way ahead of everybody else. So they have been drivers, the adult industry, for many years, but the new kids on the block are the gaming industry. So
Definitely. From
about 2009, 2010, I feel that the gaming industry, I mean, they've been doing open betas, closed betas for years and years and years.
Absolutely.
And now people in outside the gaming industry are saying, hey, we're doing betas, we're dead cool. And I'm thinking, the gaming industry has been doing this for bloody ages. You're just playing catch-up, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that beta, you know, so you hear of the Apple apps on the Apple Store can have betas now, as well as the Android apps can have betas. And they're like singing about it. Hey, yeah, we've got beaters.
It's like great.
And it's like, yeah, but the gaming industry, man, it's been vibrant for years. And if you think about the gaming industry, and this does tie into the future, traditionally, a tester sits at their desk with a desktop or a laptop or a mobile phone, and they test, don't they? Well, you think about gaming. For the last 10 years, probably the last 5-6 years, they've not sat at their desk and tested. They've had, if you think about Kinect on Microsoft platform, if you think about the Move for the PlayStation platform.
The whole Wii.
The whole Wii changed the whole landscape of what a tester's environment is. And, you know, 3D, virtual reality, augmented reality, all those kind of technologies now mean that companies in the future, if they don't invest and realise that they're going to need these spaces, and let's face it, one of the premium things companies pay for is office space.
Yeah.
If they do not create these spaces for testers and developers to create working software, how the hell they're going to move forward?
Exactly.
This is a major challenge going forward, and the future of testing, which is this podcast, is actually, this is one of the futures. And if companies at the very, very top, if they don't buy into this and start investing, they ain't going to be able to produce any of this new stuff.
Exactly.
But gaming's got this.
Yeah, games got it down.
Yeah, so I remember going to a private launch of the Microsoft Move platform. Is it called Kinect?
It's the Kinect,
And they spoke about their challenges, and it was fascinating listening to them. Chris Ambler was hosting the event, and there was about 200 people there. It was way before it went on sale. And they said that the challenges they had is they had to build lounges to represent what people would be doing.
Yeah, because you've got to make sure that you can do stuff with a coffee table and a sofa and a fireplace and all that kind of stuff. You've got to replicate that.
Yeah, and it's things like people usually have lamps in their lounge, don't they? So some people have soft lamps, some people have bright lamps, fires, the heating in the room can change. All this affected the Microsoft Kinect. And they said even bodies of humans.
Yeah.
So they said they found themselves sending people out to charity shops to get costumes or clothing to bulk them up. To make them look like overweight people or people with long hair. So if they had a team full of baldies like me, I can say that because I'm bald, they had to go out and buy wigs. So, how did the Kinect cope with hair moving around?
Yeah.
Different body shapes, different size people.
Did they get
children?
Yeah, children. Did they get cats? Cats and dogs wandering around?
Yeah.
So many different challenges.
And lights reflecting off coffee tables. Yeah. All this. And if you think about now the smart cars, we've just seen recently in the last 2 months a smart car crashed into a white lorry because the sun reflected off the white lorry, hit one of the sensors on the car, sent it into meltdown, didn't recognise the lorry and crashed into the lorry. So from moving it forward to the future of testing, how on earth are we going to test all these different things?
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
It really is.
It really is. To think about the future of testing and all the different sort of things that's coming our way. So have you seen those apps that take your picture and try and predict how old you are?
Yeah, yeah.
They're great fun, aren't they?
Yeah.
Mine came out as 110. So, and just for the record, I'm 21 years old, plus another 23. But How do you test that? Because there's no right or wrong. So I think a challenge for testing in the future is not looking for the black and white answers. It's looking for a good answer.
Yeah.
It's looking for one. So when I took my photo on that app, it came up with, I think, 46. Now, that's still acceptable to me. That's still a good answer. If it had got into the 50s, that's getting to a point where that's slightly upsetting me. If it had said 21, I'd have gone, that's brilliant, but it's massively wrong.
Yeah.
So there's a range where I would say that's a good answer. How the hell do you test for good answers?
I'd like to point out the issue I've had a similar issue, but so Wii Fit, it does a thing, you do some body exercises and stuff, and it'll tell you how old it thinks you are. And I used to be like, I used to be really unfit. Like, and at one point I injured myself, I injured my foot, and I couldn't exercise, I was really unfit. I put on a ton of weight and stuff. And I did the first time when I got out, I did the Body Fit, and I was 27 at the time. And it had me as 35. And I was like, I'm not happy with this. This does not make me want to exercise.
Yeah, so who tested that? But these intellectual sort of algorithms that sit behind these apps, they're very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. They're hard to write. If ever you've seen one, they're mind-blowing to look at. You know, someone with robotics probably wrote them. But how on earth do you set about testing that? And I think that is a real challenge for testing going forward. With so many, these algorithms are so complicated now, and the big data lakes that sit below them that pull the data and go through these intelligent algorithms. The testing involved in that, you can only look for good answers.
Yeah, it suddenly becomes a range of acceptability as opposed to this is right, done.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, let's just say I go onto a retailer website and there's a data lake that's got all my data. It's got intelligent algorithms that then feed up to the front layer to suggest that I might like a certain shirt of a certain colour. They might get that right, and they might be able to put black shirts in front of me because I only wear black. But some designs I won't like.
Yeah.
So they're trying to predict the future for me. Try testing that.
I've tested people who bought or also liked feature before, and all I could do was I can kind of, it looks, it's from the same category, broad category.
Yeah.
Like I bought some kitchen things. I was like, it's kitchen stuff, it's not the same as what I've already bought, it's in the same kind of price range ish maybe a little bit higher, but nothing made, that's all I could do.
Yeah.
And just throw as much data in there and see what,
yeah,
kind of make sure nothing completely out there. That's all you can do. And just like, does this make, and in a way it was also, and this sounds, I realise it sounds really weird in my head when I say it, but is this good for the customer, but is this also good for the company? And you've got to balance that. Do these recommendations make sense for the person that you're giving them to, but they also make sense for the company to do them? Because if I'm showing something that's ridiculously cheap,
yeah,
unless it's on sale, then that's going to lose the company money if they go to buy that. So you need to take that into it. And it sounds so dodgy, I know it does, but you've got to take that stuff into account, because at the end of the day, yeah, you want the experience to be as good for the end user, but the client's got to make money at the end of the day. They're the ones paying you.
Yeah, we're not charities.
Do you know what I mean?
I don't work for many charities.
Do you know what I mean? And it's that kind of weirdness that you've got to take into account as well.
Yeah, so I think that is a major challenge for the future of testing, is the mindset change for testers that's going to be needed,
mm-hmm,
to get their mindsets into a place where they start looking for good results rather than exact or expected results. And then all the technology that sits underneath that sort of predictive sort of product. So the app that we've spoken about that takes the picture of your face. There's also one that takes a picture of your face and tells you what dog you look like.
Yes, I mean, got a poodle.
How on earth do you test that? Do you know what I mean? It's like...
You don't.
Whoa. Yeah. So, you know, there's a real mindset change needed for testers and development teams, actually. I'm saying testers, but actually it's the agile teams as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth are they going to deliver something that fits somebody's good expectations rather than exact expectations? So I think that's one aspect of the future. Another aspect of the future is you hear so many people with so many different opinions. You need to automate everything. You need to test everything.
Yeah.
You don't need manual testers if you automate everything. And I think the actual challenge for the future for testers and testing is actually there's no silver bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone seems to think automation is the silver bullet, or this tool is now the next silver bullet.
Yeah.
Agile is the silver bullet. All these are going to solve all your pains. The future of testing and the future of technology is so complex that actually, there's no silver bullets out there, I don't believe. I think the future will be recognising which techniques, which tools suit you, and adapting very, very quickly to them.
Yeah.
Slow adapting will lead to failure, will lead to loss of revenue.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge for the testers is to recognise very, very quickly in a much shorter period than, say, a waterfall team works in, to recognise that they've got to act a lot quicker. I think open source tools are already the driving force in a lot of technology developments.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's only going to grow. We're seeing that with, I won't say the actual name of the company that I went out to visit in India, but they're already recognising that they need to move away from their test tool suite, and now they're looking at open source tools.
Yeah.
And that was a really exciting journey to go over there, and I thought I was going over to have their tool set rammed down my throat, and actually it was the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
The message I got from this big company based in India was, we're actually changing. We're going to move to open source tools.
Yeah.
We're going to put a framework in place that allows you to choose which open source tools suit you. And that was music to my ears. I was that's cool. You've gone from being uncool to super cool in the space of a minute. And, you know, I was really excited to hear that. So, yeah, there's so much sort of going on with sort of the future of testing. I think the main one that's going to be a major challenge for us is we're going to be asked to do more with less.
Yeah.
As test teams, testers, developers doing testing, we're going to be asked to do more with less. And I've already mentioned that automation, people think that's the silver bullet, but automation for me plays a major, major role. I'm going to come on to a topic where I think Dan Ashby and Friendly Tester are very passionate about this, and I've got a different view to them, and it's the triangle of testing. And I don't know whether you've seen it. It's a triangle that states that at the bottom you have as much automated unit tests as possible.
Yeah.
So you're automating, your main effort should be going into automating of unit tests, and that's your developers with testers' help.
Mm-hmm.
And then you automate, and we saw it yesterday in the Liverpool Tester Gathering, you automate the testing at the API level and the integration tests as much as you can. And then you automate as much of your GUI tests as possible.
Yeah.
And then you have your manual testing at the top of the triangle. And again, if you go into Google and just type in the testing pyramid or the testing triangle, you'll get this diagram up that I've got up on my screen right now. And this diagram, more than any other diagram, I think drives more discussion than any other picture out there. I think Friendly Tester really isn't a fan of this. I think it's a holy grail.
Yeah.
I think it's something a lot of companies simply won't get to.
No.
I mean, basically, I've got another picture next to it, which is the inverted diagram, which is where a lot of companies are at, where a lot of the effort goes into testing at the GUI level and the manual level, whereas actually we should be trying to reverse that and say, right, let's push as much automated testing down to the developer unit level.
Yeah.
Because that enables testers to go and add value at what they do, testing instead of checking.
Exactly.
So you heard somebody refer to checking yesterday. I think it was Mark referred to checking and testing. And a lot of people still don't get that it's two different things, and anything that's a check should be automated. And then release testers. Let them release their skill sets of their craft and their trade that they've studied so hard to be. Let them add value. So this diagram, I think, is absolutely key, because too many companies, and the companies I've worked at, we put so much effort into the UI level that we don't actually push enough testing down to developers. And guess what? Speaking to developers at the company I'm in now, they want to do automated unit tests.
Yeah, I mean, when we're discussing getting more automation in our company at the moment, and at the moment developers do a lot of the BHAT testing. They don't want to give that up.
Mm.
They like having that control and that testing. They like just the knowledge that the developers I work with, I'm really lucky that the majority of them will do a sniff test of their work. They'll deploy it and they'll make sure it works at a basic level. Is it there? Does it do roughly what I expect it to do? And the BHAT tests allow them to double check that as well. And they like knowing that they're passing over something to me that works, and I'm just looking around for the stuff that they've missed and scenarios that they've missed, and they don't want to give that up.
Yeah.
And I'm there with, in these discussions, the representative of the test team going, the developers do not want to give this up, and I don't think we should take that from them.
Yeah,
we should give them more, if anything. We should just add the stuff that we would, our pain points. We shouldn't take their pain points from them, and we should give them the tools to do that, and we'll just automate our pain points.
Yeah. So this was interesting, because we've been out to see many companies in the Northwest. We've been out to see BBC, Late Rooms, PlayStation. to see how they tackle this pyramid of testing diagram. And it was really interesting speaking to BBC because they said that they loaded all their automation and late rooms, they loaded all their automation into the UI level. And then they realised that wasn't the right strategy. There was a few things that happened that made them realise that actually they need to reverse that. I mean, if you automate at the UI level, there's only one thing that's going to happen. Those UI automated tests are going to grow and grow and grow. And when you run your automated UI test suite, there's only one thing that's going to happen. Your feedback loop to development is going to get longer and longer and longer. Because everyone says, oh, automation saves time, but it's the analysis that takes the time.
Yeah.
And if you're just automating at the UI level, there's going to be a huge analysis every time you run your test to then feed back to development and say, actually, we think these are issues. What BBC realised, and Late Rooms, is that they streamlined their UI automated tests. They put just the bare minimum, what's important to the user, and that's all they automated at the UI level. And they pushed everything else. They call it push left or shift left, whereas in the pyramid it would be push down. And they pushed all unit testing and automated it at developer level.
Yeah.
And the value they said that added was phenomenal, because when a developer checks and if they see something's wrong, they can fix it there and then.
Exactly.
Whereas if you automate at the UI or test at the UI level, you then raise a defect, it goes through the defect life cycle, and it adds time and cost. So those two companies that we've been out to see have really inspired us to say, we need to change here at the company I'm working at now. We need, because all we're doing is building and building up our automated GUI tests, UI tests, and it's getting to be an unmanageable suite of automated tests.
Yeah.
And every time a new feature comes in, we automate it at the UI level, and guess what? The pack just grows and grows and grows.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we're saying, hey, we need more automation testers because our pack's getting bigger and bigger. Well, that's the same argument as, I need more testers because our regression pack's getting bigger and bigger. No, you apply risk to your regression pack. So I think this is an absolute pivotal part of any software house moving forward and a challenge of testing. And this diagram, when you put it up in front of testers, it can strike fear. Because when you show them the pyramid of testing and they see the little bubble at the top, which is manual testing, they see that, oh, that doesn't leave me much to do. But it's actually adding values at unit tests, you know, helping developers automate those unit tests, helping the developer or even themselves automating the API tests, automating the UI tests. Why can't manual testers do that?
Exactly.
You're doing it with some of your pain points.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the exploratory session-based testing or exploratory testing, manual testing at the top, that's adding value.
Yeah.
And then, of course, everything we spoke about earlier about enabling other teams as well, the UAT, the end user, I think that is absolutely pivotal to the future of testing as a whole.
Yeah, I think that does, when you free up testers to do other stuff. I had a discussion last night about metrics and about bugs per, someone wanted to do bugs per however long, and I'm like, there are some days where I don't actually do any testing. I'm so busy talking, I'm doing documentation, I'm talking to clients, I'm doing that, and that adds value.
Yeah.
My value as a tester is not just testing things.
Yeah.
It's the information that I gather that I can spread about.
And how do you measure that? How do you prove that you're adding value there? That's a real challenge, isn't it?
It's a huge challenge, but if you're spending all your time doing masses of manual testing, you might hit some bugs and you can throw some numbers at, but you're not spreading that knowledge and that value about, which I think is such an important part of a role.
Yeah, God, I remember being at Sony Ericsson and we had a test day, and the test team went and just tested a different area, and this just taps into your metrics conversation. So one tester found something like 30 defects in one day. Woohoo, brilliant. But they're all spelling mistakes.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas this one guy found two absolute brilliant defects, spent the whole day chasing down these two defects that really added value to the quality of the software. And I know spelling mistakes are poor and they shouldn't happen, but that guy who raised all those spelling mistakes got an award for raising 26, 28 defects in one day. And the guy who raised the two got no recognition at all. And we've got an example at the company I'm at now where we have a metric where we've got rid of it, but we used to measure testers on how many tests and how many defects they found. But we always found there was one guy who was always at the bottom. But when we stood back and looked at who adds value, he was the guy who was at the top.
Yeah.
Because he was doing exactly what you've said. He was helping the developers automate at unit level. He was enabling the customers and the UAT guys to test earlier. But his stats said that he wasn't doing a good job.
Yeah.
What's all that about?
It's so hard.
Yeah, it's hard to actually relay that to people, to project managers,
yeah,
to CIOs. I think anything like that where project managers are very much, I want to know how many test cases you're running each day. I want to know how many defects test X, Y, and Z, because it's costing me money, I'm paying for these guys. Well, actually, it's not all numbers driven. It's, as you say, the value add.
It is the same as giving developers a metric of lines of code that they've
written. Yeah, yeah, it really is. I mean, yeah, it's mind-blowing how some... And we're guilty here. We still use metrics in the wrong way, but we're trying to evolve slowly.
Yeah.
And I think the main people to influence there are the project managers.
Mm-hmm. Because their reports are... They are based on numbers. They're based on... You know, how much profit they're making, all that kind of stuff. So they need the numbers to make their numbers work.
Yeah.
It is changing. It has to be top down.
Yeah.
It has to be, everyone has to be less reliant on numbers, but numbers are what you need. It's so hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting this. So in the waterfall world, the project managers ask for a test plan. I need to see a test plan. It needs to be signed off by everybody. How many, in a waterfall world, how many development teams create a development plan?
Yeah.
And it goes through the same vigorous revision process as a test plan.
Exactly.
Not many development teams do, and that's why I love Agile.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden the team comes together,
mm-hmm.
and you get the 10-minute test. The 10-minute test plan is something that came from James Whittaker in 2011, and he talked us through this 10-minute test plan. He said, "Why do test teams create test plans that are 70 pages long that no one reads?" He said, "Do a 10-minute test plan."
Yeah.
And he showed us a template of it, and we were like, "That's brilliant." And every company I've been to, I've introduced the 10-minute test plan.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want more, okay, we'll give a little bit more. But we start as a basis, 10-minute, 3-pager, that's our test plan.
Yeah, done.
Yeah, and it's working miracles here at the company I'm at now. People are getting through a lot more work and adding value rather than writing a document people don't read.
Yeah.
So moving on again regarding the future of testing. We've already spoken in our previous podcast about the quadrants of testing, so I'm not going to cover it too much, but I do feel a tester in the future needs to think about their skill sets, needs to think about how they add value. They need to move away from just being manual functional testers.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be slightly more rounded. I think in the future testers need to get more aligned to developers and to the user. So they got caught in a hard and a soft place there, aren't they? But if anybody wants to know more about the agile testing quadrants, we did discuss it quite a bit in our last podcast.
Yeah.
But I think it is an important part of the future. Oh, I've got a lovely way of bringing automation to life. Sorry, I've got to go back to this.
Do it.
So, automating your pain. It's got to be a thing of the future. Too many people think about test automation. Automate your tests at the UI level. Automate your unit tests. What about automating your pain points?
Yeah.
So there was a guy who has become a mythical figure. I don't know whether this is an urban myth or not, but we spoke about it last night at the tester gathering, and he automated his pains. And this is definitely something we're definitely looking at this company I'm at now, as in this is definitely something in the next 2-3 years, which is going to be our future, which is automating our pains. And the guy that we're talking about last night, he had several pains, and he looked at, if anything takes him more than 90 seconds to do, he's going to try and automate it. So I think that's a cool mentality, full stop. But the examples that he did, and I only found this code on his machine after he left, apparently. He automated ordering a coffee from the coffee machine. He broke into the API, and he realised, and he timed it, it took him 21 seconds to walk from his desk to the coffee machine. So he set up an automated script to hack into the API of the coffee machine, set up his coffee, do it, brew it, dispense it within 21 seconds so he could leave his desk, walk to the coffee machine and just pick it up and walk away without paying, because he bypassed the payment mechanism within the coffee machine. Now that's a great automating your pain. And another thing he did was, his wife was a pain. She'd bug him all day with emails, so he started doing automated email responses to his own wife. So he'd analyse the contents of her email, and he would then pull out an automated response that would align to the question she was asking. Things like, "Sorry, honey, I'm working late." And all this was automated. And I think it's a great example of automating your pain. So let's look at tennis.
Yep.
Right, and this is a real good example of why you need automation and manual testers. So Andy Murray, I'm sure he uses one of those machines that ping a tennis ball to a certain point on a court 100 times in a minute. Now, if I was Andy Murray and my backhand was a pain and I was no good at it, I would use one of these automated machines to ping the ball to a certain part of the court so he could practice his backhand.
Yeah.
Now, a human probably wouldn't be very good at pinging that ball to exactly the same spot every time. But these machines are great.
Yeah.
So that's why tennis players use them. But then would that be Andy Murray's only strategy for getting better? Of course it wouldn't.
No.
He'd want to spar or play tennis with other people with different skills that ping the ball back in different ways.
The unpredictableness of it all.
Yeah. So he automates his pain by using one of those lovely ping machines. But then the manual sort of side, he needs manual intervention.
Yeah.
And this is why I think we need a future where the balance of automation and a manual tester has to be better than it is now.
Yeah.
Because it's wrong at the moment. We've already spoken about that testing pyramid. I'd say 95% of companies are nowhere near that testing pyramid. I'd say 95% of testers are nowhere near the quadrants, the skill sets mentioned in the agile quadrants.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere near.
No.
So in the future, we've got to move to this balance where the testers have addressed the quadrants and the skill sets, and companies have looked at where automation adds value, where it kills the pain points, and testers need to say, well, I can complement automation with my wonderful exploratory testing skills and some structured testing, if need be. So I think that is a real challenge for any company, because at the end of the day, we simply don't know who's going to use our software and what they're going to use it for.
No.
So I always use the... I've got a picture up in front of me of a child with a tablet. So you imagine... I've got kids. So my kids had tablets going back 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
So you imagine on Christmas Day, this happens. The child comes down and he goes, "Way, look at this, I've got an iPad." And they open it up and they go, "Oh, brilliant." And they turn it on. And the parent at that point interjects and says, "You know what, son? Just park it there because I've got all this documentation for you to read. I've got Apple's requirements backlog.
Yeah.
I've got Apple's test cases. I've got Apple's defects. So this is where you need to avoid. Just read all those, please, 5-year-old boy, before you actually start using the iPad." It doesn't happen, does it?
No.
Because a kid goes on and just uses it how they want to use it. And that's why the strategy of testing in the future is so important, because we simply don't know who's going to use our software and how they're going to use it.
We were discussing this last night in the pub, and we were talking about the shoe test. Do you know the thing where you put a shoe on a keyboard?
Yes.
I think and I was saying that should be updated to the cat walking across a keyboard test.
Yes, I've had that.
And the baby sitting on the lamp test. Because a shoe is fine, but it'll just press those buttons, whereas a cat walking across a keyboard has all the time. Babies.
Oh, yeah. All day.
Do it.
We had a new kitten just before Christmas, and I was working from home, and I had my works laptop and my private laptop both up and running, both doing different stuff. And the kitten was very affectionate, wanted to be near whoever was in the house, and I was only the only person in the house. So she comes and sits on my private laptop.
Yeah.
And she's black, and the keyboard was black, so I never saw that she was there.
Yeah, because you were...
Yeah, and all of a sudden, the computer almost goes up in flames.
Yeah,
I'm exaggerating a bit, but you get the point. And it is, it's those kind of tests. I think Michael Bolton refers to it as the book test.
Yeah.
So you get a book and you just put it on the keyboard, walk away for half an hour, come back, what's happened?
Mm-hmm.
And it's that what if.
Yeah.
That what if. We're all explorers. I believe human beings have an exploring gene in them, otherwise we wouldn't be where we are today. But in testers, it's cranked right up, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So testers, we have it almost up to 11 on a scale of 10. We're almost up to 11 on that exploratory gene. And I believe that we need to nurture that exploratory gene. And in an interview process, it's what I look for is this person, are they curious?
Mm-hmm.
Are they an explorer? Do they ask the what if questions? If they just reel off all this standard ISTQB stuff to me, then I tend to switch off a bit.
Yeah.
I want testers to demonstrate that they can explore, that they're curious, that they can do the what ifs, because in the world I want to move to, that's what the testers will be doing.
Yeah.
Session-based testing, exploratory testing, and then adding value to the automation side as well, looking at the security, looking at the performance, and changing their mindsets. That's what I'm looking for in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of testers who are nowhere near that.
Yeah.
It's a scary world out there. So should we say Internet of Things?
Yes.
So that, I mean, that is, we know it's coming. It's here. It's only going to grow. And it goes back to our conversation about that app that takes your picture. How on earth do you test the intelligent algorithms? Well, Internet of Things, for me, has a couple of things which are very, very testable. The key one being security.
Yeah, the security testing is going to be big.
Oh.
I mean, it's big anyway, but it's going to be even bigger when your whole house is going to be connected. In fact, I don't know if you watch Mr. Robot.
No.
But one of the first episodes of season 2... someone had, it's an Amazon show, so it was all Alexa, Amazon's thing in the house, and someone hacked into it and the house went haywire, there was music playing loud, temperature went everywhere. Her whole house was connected. She couldn't do anything because someone had hacked in and just made it go haywire.
I mean, this is fascinating because this is one thing I get really excited about, the Internet of Things. One, we'll talk about the hot tub from James Whittaker's talk, but the one thing is, you imagine this, is it called Hive, the heating stuff that you can have in your house?
Yep.
Now, you imagine I'm a really naughty person from Birmingham who sits...
Never imagine a naughty person from Birmingham.
Yeah, and I've got some hacking skills. So I decide to park myself in a very nice posh estate, and I can hack into maybe four or five houses on their Wi-Fi. Oh, look, Hive is on the Wi-Fi network. Oh, look, they've set themselves to be on holiday for 2 weeks. And that house over there, number three, they're on holiday in August. Yeah. And that house over there, they're on holiday in September. I can see that because I've just hacked into their Wi-Fi. I can see that their heating systems are set for those holiday modes. Yep. Therefore, now that I've got that information, I can now inform my very, very naughty people from Birmingham to come up and rob their houses.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so all of a sudden, security is key.
I have two things to say. First of all, I grew up in Wolverhampton, so I'm allowed to say that Birmingham people are naughty. I know my accent doesn't sound like it, but I did. And there was a thing that I read where someone bought a CCTV style system you can get for your house.
Yeah, yeah.
And he bought it, but it had been a refurb one. But it was still connected up to the old person, so he could see the other person's camera feed.
Oh wow.
And he was like, and he was a developer, so he was like, he was like, I could just see someone else's house, you know, whatever. Because they'd refurb, but not. And I think it was part of the other people, because this is another thing, the other people hadn't cleared their security settings because people don't understand this stuff. They're going to buy this Hive or Nest or there's one way you can get where that's just started, it's an American company that's just started being advertised over here where it's a camera in your doorbell.
Wow.
And you can, and for everywhere you are, it's Wi-Fi, so you can talk to people who are ringing your doorbell and see who's ringing your doorbell from anywhere. And in the advert, it's like a family coming home and ring the doorbell and they can talk to the dad who's at work through the doorbell. And it's just like, you can just see who's, it's just so many things, but people aren't going to be aware of how to set security, and we can't expect people to do the 16 characters, uppercase, lowercase, number, hieroglyph.
Yeah.
You know.
People just aren't thinking about security, and a great example is how many people have tablets or mobile phones and don't put antivirus on there.
Exactly.
They're getting hacked left, right and centre, and they don't understand why. It's because you haven't thought about security, but people aren't educated. You can't expect people outside of IT to be thinking about security.
Yeah.
So the future of testing is actually to drive that, and everything we do, what keeps my CIO awake at night, I know what it is, and it's security.
Yeah.
Are our customers safe when they come on our website?
Yeah.
Now, you take that to the Internet of Things. When somebody sells the Nest, which has the CCTV, the heating, all in combined, is their information safe? They're transmitting bloody pictures of their kids on CCTV, which they think is staying internal. But if someone hacks that, what if like your kid is walking around in a towel and there's some kind of naughty person hacking it and takes those images, puts them on the internet?
Because it's all been sent over Wi-Fi.
Exactly. So unless we as testers ask ourselves, is this secure? Not only does it work, but we need to start asking ourselves, is it secure?
Yeah.
And that is a key thing of the Internet of Things. And I love, so security is one thing, but I must tell you the hot tub story from James Whittaker. It's brilliant. So typical James Whittaker comes on stage and he's very flamboyant. I'm not going to try and do his voice, but I'll just try and translate his story. Basically hot tubs. Who'd have thought hot tubs was on the brink of Internet of Things and driving technology? So in America, a lot of Americans have hot tubs. When you tell this story in Europe, or especially India, as I did last week, it's a bit lost on, the people from India looking at me to say, what's a hot tub? But basically, you imagine a hot tub, you have to maintain it with chemicals.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, once every week you have to go, or once a day you have to go and measure the chemical and say, does it need some more chemicals putting in? No, it doesn't. Then you go back the next day. And eventually you run out of chemicals. All the hot tub breaks down. But this is what's happening on hot tubs, and this is what makes hot tubs really cool. They have sensors, because Internet of Things is all about sensors,
sensors
that collects data. So hot tubs now have sensors. They are now connected to the Wi-Fi. Hot tubs now sense when they're using the sensors, when their chemicals are running low. So now, over Wi-Fi, they ask other hot tubs, seriously, on a network of hot tubs all talking to each other. It feels like Termination Day or Terminator Day. They're talking to each other and going, hey, I'm running low on this chemical. What do you use? So they all exchange data.
Yeah.
And then let's just say my hot tub receives all this data and it goes, okay, I can see that hot tub over there gets chemical A from provider A, but it runs out every 2 days, whereas hot tub B over there gets a chemical that lasts a week. So actually, it's more efficient to buy that one. So again, with no human interaction, it purchases the chemical, asks for it to be delivered at a time that suits the family,
yeah,
because it knows the family movements. It pays for it all without any human interactions. And this is where it will go further. What if one day that chemical gets delivered by a drone, yeah, who just injects it into the hot tub and drones off?
Yeah.
All with no human interaction. How the hell are we going to test that?
Exactly. It's going to be just ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's another thing, actually, another story. Did you hear about the automatic pet feeder that went down?
No.
So there was a company that does automatic. You can set it up and it automatically dispenses a certain amount of pet food. So if you're out away, your cat can still get fed. Their servers went down, so they couldn't feed it. The feeder stopped working.
Oh,
and they just
no.
sent out a message to people going, yeah, our servers have gone down, so please manually feed your pets. And they were like...
But we're 1,000 miles away. We bought your product to do this.
Basically, the email was, sorry, your cat died, but our servers went down.
Well, it's funny you say that about breaking down. Even the hot tubs, when they break down, they talk to other hot tubs and say, this part has broken. Has this broken down on your hot tub? And if it says yes, it then asks the question, who did you get out to repair it?
Amazing.
And sends... Unbelievable, isn't it? And that's hot tubs driving the Internet of Things.
That's incredible.
I love that story. And it's in the James Whittaker Big Data video that's on YouTube. You can watch it. But he tells it far funnier and far better than I ever could. But it's amazing because you would never associate hot tubs with the future of testing.
No.
Or the future of Internet of Things. But it's driving it.
Yeah.
So when we're all taken over by robots, we'll trace it back to hot tubs. Yeah, yeah.
That's a hot take from this podcast. Beware hot tubs.
Yeah, don't let them take over. But yeah, I thought that was really... So security for me is the main thing, but also the challenge of how do you test for all the different combinations. We've already spoken about the car that crashed, the automated car. It's only going to get bigger. There's only going to be more radical things. Here's another great example of Internet of Things. If you're driving around London, you can press a button. This is in the future. You'll be able to press a button that then searches for a parking space as close to you as possible.
Yeah.
Hence, they're pulling out the green card. It's going to save petrol. Once you've secured and paid for that parking space, a barrier will come up to stop anybody else getting into it.
Oh, wow.
And as you get within 5 metres, the barrier will come down. You will pull in, all without any human interaction apart from pressing that one button to say, I want parking. And all the payments and everything, and your sat nav will guide you in. It'll get to the point where the car will drive itself there.
Yeah,
but it's all through sensors and it's all through no human interaction. How are you going to test all this stuff?
Yeah, it does come down to that. Humans are unpredictable up to a point. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of ways. But another thing that fascinates me about is when we have more of these things out, because we test so many things in isolation. There's one instance of running, we performance, like load testing, will mock stuff. There's one thing doing. If there's one thing and another thing's going to mess it up, I mean, the opposite, the hot tubs, which work by talking to each other. If you test in isolation, then all of a sudden something else comes overrides it. Like in the parking thing, if two people are roughly the same distance away from that parking space, how does that give priority if two people press it at the same time? Which isn't... London's a big city, it's not out of...
Absolutely. Who gets also, the priority?
Yeah. Also, testing that, you need to build a street.
Well, that brings me on to probably the next part of the future, which is I think we'll see more testing in live.
It's going to have to be.
Yeah,
some stuff.
Yeah, so we've already got A-B testing and A-B-C testing, which is experiments that are putting live without the user knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And our company here, we are very aggressive in this area. So we get our users to test theories out for us.
Yeah.
We look at the return on investment. We see if it's worked. And then we put it into production across the whole site if, say, experiment A has proven to be more successful than experiment B. Now, it's more about look and feel A-B testing.
Yeah,
so it's more
yeah.
about if we change this button to be green,
will more people
come and buy it. But nevertheless, it is a form of testing in live.
Yeah.
And speaking to Chris Thacker from Late Rooms, they have an awful lot of alerting and testing in live to see, once we've put it live, is it still working?
Yeah.
And if something goes wrong in live, and you were talking about your process where it broke the other week
and
it was a painful thing to go through, but if you had monitoring and alerting in live, testing in live, you probably would have picked it up immediately. You could have rolled back pretty quick. And this is one thing, Chris Thacker, if ever you get a conversation or a chance to do a podcast with Chris, I'd really recommend it, because he said that in late rooms, they roll small changes out, but if it goes wrong, the live monitoring picks it up so quickly that they can roll it back very, very quickly without the customer even realising.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some companies are very lucky that their solutions allow them to do that, but I do think live testing, it's almost been a bit of a swear word in the last sort of two decades, but actually I think it's the future.
I think so. I think it's going to have to be.
Yeah. And, you know, as well as A-B testing, you've got your crowdsourcing, which is, you know, that can either be done in testing or in live. And I think crowdsourcing adds great value in some instances. The breadth of users that these companies have at their disposal is absolutely mind-blowing. So if you're a game producer and you want your game's going to go global, there's no better way of testing globally than activating the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, your test team aren't global.
No.
They're, you know, if I think of Sony, the test team is predominantly Europe, America and Japan, but the games are sold all around the world.
Exactly.
So crowdsourcing and A-B testing and testing in live, I think, is going to be something that we've already seen crowdsourcing take off. We've already seen A-B and A-B-C testing taken off. But I think this will evolve somehow in the future to be even stronger.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, because crowdsourcing is, there's so many different things people do with crowdsourcing as it is, whether it comes to paying for things or, I mean, we've seen big data. There's loads of experiments with big data that crowdsourcing, I think testing is just going to follow. Because you can already get, you can even get stuff where, like, you can sign your computer for things and it will use the memory of a computer when you're not using it to research, like, how proteins fold and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's already in basically every aspect. Testing will just follow where you can, I mean, there's things, but you have to sign up for, like, you testing or something where you can, but I think they'll be much more open, sort of come test a thing and you'll go and do it.
Yeah, I was surprised how cumbersome and painful the registration process for you testing actually was.
Yeah.
I was really disappointed. I thought I'd go and have a look, see what they were about. And the registration process, I thought that's enough to put people off.
I think that's aimed at professional testers who want to, it's not aimed at people like, you just want to get people to test some stuff.
Yeah.
I think there is a space for something quick and easy, just sign up, put some basic demographic details in, and then people can say, I need this many people to test this kind of product, and then that just poof, and that's it.
Yeah.
You get it sent out to those people and they'll test it for you.
I think for crowdsourcing to succeed going forward, they need to be able to almost look at the Google one-click bug that I discussed
earlier, something like that.
And make it easier. Because let's face it, the public are far more savvy about technology now than, say, 10 years ago. Everyone's got a phone where they download apps. I think the world has come to accept that you get an upgrade or a new patch delivered with bug fixes in. I think the public are understanding that software has defects in. Whereas 20 years ago, they probably wouldn't have understood the terminology. But I think now the actual public are a lot more tech savvy and understand that software has upgrades and it has bugs in it and has patches delivered. My Samsung TV's had 30 patches delivered to it.
Yeah.
It's a way of life now.
Yeah, exactly. I think people are a lot more, there's a threshold, I think, of defects that might even be like a lot higher outside than inside, I think. And also, we're growing up with a generation now who's never not seen computers.
Yeah.
And that's a whole new
that
we're aiming at, and a whole new interaction with technology going forward. I think that's going to change a lot of things, just because they're going to expect different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what I worry about the future? I worry about my own future. So we're speaking about the future of testing, but I'm 44. You're a lot younger than me, Jem, but I worry, how do I keep myself relevant in my job? So I'm guessing the people that listen to your podcast vary in age groups. And the one thing that almost keeps me awake at night is, when the next recession hits, how old am I going to be and how relevant am I going to be?
I worry about being relevant. I'm 29 this year and I worry about keeping myself relevant.
You know, I see a lot of new kids coming on the block every day. We've got two apprentices here at the company I'm at, and they're fantastic. They're 18 years old and their attitude is fantastic. They're tech savvy. They're a joy to behold. They've come with new ideas. And I just think to myself, wow, I'm 44, they're 18. In probably 10 years' time, they'll probably be my boss. But how do I keep adding value every single day? And I know this is a conversation about the future of testing, but maybe the future of testers is relevant as well.
Definitely.
which is how in 10 years' time am I still going to be in a job?
Yeah, the thing that keeps me awake at night in a way is there are so many, like, the future of testing is a vast place.
Oh.
I don't know which bit of future testing I want to be in, never mind which one I fit in.
Yeah.
And I have, and there's so much stuff to think about and to learn. And because I said I'm a manual tester, I've only been in the job like 2 years. And I'm just like going, I don't know how to, I need to pick something. What if I pick the wrong thing?
Yeah.
It's so hard to sit down and go, right, this is what I'm going to do. This is what grabs me out of the whole vast thing of testing. This is what I'm going to specialise in. And I'm like, I can't.
Yeah.
To know what to do, I get like just paralysis of.
I mean, if someone said to me, "Oh, you've been in testing 18 years, Lee, you must be a testing expert," and I said, "Whoa, I am far from a testing expert."
Yeah.
If you think about all the different aspects of testing, it's huge. And then if you throw in all the different technologies and all the different devices, platforms, if you throw in healthcare where people can die if you get something wrong, space travel where people can die. Retail software, no one dies, but it's all about money.
Yeah.
And it's so vast that if anybody stands up and says they're a testing expert, I do actually question whether they are, because it's just such a big world and the future of testing is only going to get bigger.
Yeah.
So it's, I think you're right, it's about finding your niche and saying, right, what am I going to enjoy?
Yeah, and they're just going with it.
Yeah.
I think that's what you've got to do. And I've actually done an episode previously about how I feel very magpie-ish in the world of testing at the moment, because there's so many shiny things that I just go into. And
yeah.
And just trying to focus on one thing that I can still magpie about shallowly, but I need to be T-shaped. I need to have that depth. Yeah. And at the moment, I'm just still trying to find it.
Yeah, I suppose we started with, you know, talking about the tester gathering. And I think for me to stay relevant, it's about staying relevant in the community.
Yeah.
It's about getting out into the community, talking to others, giving back.
Yeah.
So where I've got stuff to give back, give it back for free. And it's about being, I'm a great believer in the days where you rock up to your company and do a 9-to-5 and your company train you. I think those days have gone.
Yeah.
I think they're over. It's all about self-development. And the one way I'm trying to stay relevant is by doing a lot of self-development.
Mm-hmm.
I often have weekends where I lock myself away for a couple of days and do a deep dive into a certain area. And that's absolutely key. And I think the future of testers is to have to sacrifice your own time and do self-development.
And I think you can see that in the testing community, because there's always something training going on. There's so many different meetups. The fact that Test Bash is now in like 5 different places.
Yeah.
There's so much drive and so much people wanting to do things and wanting to get out there and do stuff. I think that is just the culture of testing in a way.
Yeah, I do sense there's still people who feel they can rock up 9-to-5, do their job, do the bare minimum. That happens in every trade.
Oh, it happens every trade.
Every trade you get those kind of people. But companies now are saying, yes, we will invest in you, we'll put you on training, but you've also got to show a willing of self-development as well.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't change your mindset to have that, there is a danger that the testing in you will die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you'll be got rid of. Companies, I think, will change their mindsets eventually and say, actually, you're not adding any value.
Yeah.
You're coming to work, you're doing your job, we're having to invest in you, but we're not getting anything back.
Yeah,
and that's a real challenge for testers, a big mindset change there. So, to summarise, testing isn't dead. It's very much alive. It's very vibrant. There's a strong community. There's loads going on in the future to keep us busy.
Oh, yeah.
There's loads for us to get our teeth into. And I think your point's really good, actually, choosing where to go in that future.
Yeah.
It
you
really
can't be
is.
In all the futures.
No.
You have to pick one. And it's going to be exciting. I'm so... Every time I talk about this stuff, I'm really excited. It's just making that choice.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, it's been really good. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for coming over to sunny Liverpool, and I've really enjoyed the two podcasts. Thanks, Jo.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much.
So, listeners, that is it. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I will be back, like I said, next week with another episode. Notes on what we talked about are on Let's Talk About Test.xyz, and you can leave a comment there if you want to leave feedback. If you want to leave feedback on Twitter, it's at Let's Talk Tests, or it's letstalkabouttests@gmail.com. If you really want to go all out, you can rate or review on iTunes, because that's always helpful. And I will see you in a week's time. Bye.
Our planet would be just a point of light.